Hey everyone, and welcome to Social Sport. I'm your host, Emma Zimmerman, and this show is a member of the Sidious Mag podcast network. On this show, I feature conversations with endurance athletes committed to fostering social change. Okay, stick with me as I tell you something groundbreaking. Are you ready? Sports are not the center of the world, not when we consider all of the big topics and issues that exist in this world. But at the same time, sports are the center of the world. Endurance sports provide us with a great avenue to explore the topics that really matter, from climate change to mental health to equity and inclusion. So come along as my guests and I explore one question: how are endurance sports a powerful platform for social change? Big thank you to Ope Running for sponsoring the Social Sport podcast. Ope Running is an ethical running apparel brand designed and produced in Minnesota. The mission of Ope is truly incredible. Their performance apparel is high quality with bold colors and breathable fabrics. And this apparel is made especially for runners who care about their impact on our planet and the people who reside here. Ope even offsets the carbon emissions for every single order they ship. One of my favorite items of theirs is the Tiny Lil Short. Yes, all of their products have fun names like Tiny Lil Short. I have these shorts in the ocean blue color and they're super bright and breathable. I'll definitely be rocking them on the run, especially now that the weather is warming up. Go to operunning.com and use code SOCIALSPORT at checkout to get 15% off your order. Again, that's operunning.com and code SOCIALSPORT. Today, we have an incredibly important conversation and an incredibly strong woman joining us. Rosie Cruz is a senior Division I cross-country and track runner for Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. On March 26, she publicly shared the abuse that she and others faced in the Loyola Marymount cross-country and track programs. This abuse included psychological manipulation, enabled disordered eating, and physical and emotional harm. Unfortunately, Rosie's story is not new. We've heard it before. It has always had different names. We've heard it with the name Nike Oregon Project, Wesleyan University, University of Arizona. The list goes on. There is a problem in the sport of distance running and in the NCAA, and that's what Rosie hopes to fight through her story. I wanted to give Rosie the chance to tell all of her story unfiltered, so there are definitely some sensitive subjects mentioned in this episode, including eating disorders, emotional abuse, and attempted suicide. If those topics are triggering to you, please consider this your warning and take care of yourself. Now, on to my conversation with the incredibly brave Rosie Cruz. Hey, Rosie, welcome to Social Sport. I am so appreciative of you for taking the time to chat today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Of course. Could you tell listeners who you are, where you are right now, and what you're passionate about?
Yeah, so I'm Rosie Cruz. I am a current slash former Division I runner at Loyola Marymount University. I am currently in Boulder, Colorado. I've been here since the pandemic hit. I consider it my second home, and there's great running here, so I decided to live out here when the pandemic hit. So yeah.
I love Boulder, Colorado. I feel like that's the ideal place to be right now and always.
It's the running mecca of the world. Sorry.
Totally. Whenever I talk to someone who's in Boulder, I just like have this wave of jealousy wash over me because I'm in New York. So like, why do I live here again? But yeah, I'm so happy that you get to be there right now. So you're in Boulder, but my understanding is that you grew up in the Bay Area and you had lots of success in high school, cross country and track, even though you started running pretty late in your high school career. My understanding is you were a junior. Could you tell me a bit more about that experience with running in high school?
Yeah, totally. So I actually started playing soccer probably when I was like 5 years old, and I was on a super competitive soccer team. It was called La Mirinda Soccer Club, and my team at one point was the number one team in the nation. I thought I was going to go Division I for soccer. I was a midfielder, so like I ran all the time. And I think I was better at running than most people at that time. And I actually enjoyed doing sprints and stuff. And so I sort of like found my passion for running during that. But definitely my junior year, I had broken my ankle in soccer, just like a fluke injury, got side tackled and was out. And it kind of like changed the course of my life because, you know, in soccer, you get recruited when you're a lot younger, like probably your freshman, sophomore year. And I had been talking to people and I was just sort of unsure of what I was going to do. But once I broke my ankle, it just changed everything. And so I had to come back pretty late and I was feeling nervous about, you know, getting back in time to really have a chance at like college athletics with soccer. And I decided to go out to track practice my junior year. And I was like, this is going to be the way I get back. But as soon as I got to track practice, like the first practice I was there, I was like, I love this sport. Like, this is where I'm meant to be. Like, I need to be here. And so I ended up quitting soccer, which was like insane because my whole identity was wrapped up into, you know, my soccer team and, my whole life revolved around it. I even was like, you know, I flew to Sweden for a soccer tournament with my team and once I quit, I still ended up going and playing, but I was like committed to running at that point. So yeah, it's kind of interesting because like I was very late to the game with running and my coach really saw a lot of potential in me. I think my first race was like an 800 meter race and I ran like 2:35 or something really like just not that great, but he saw a lot of potential in me. So
that's not slow for a high schooler at all. Like, you know, that's definitely not slow. I would even say that's fast on the high school level. But what's cool to me is, you know, I think that soccer running progression is pretty common for a runner, but right now, I mean, you're using your experience in running to really speak out about an issue, which we'll get into later. But it seems like for you, sports has always not just been sports. I read a bit about the soccer camp that you created in Guatemala for girls. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. So my dad is a doctor and he does like medical missions to Nuevo Progreso, Guatemala. And so one of my former teammates on my soccer team and I, we decided that we were going to, you know, go out there with my dad and help him, but also start a soccer camp there. So we ended up doing that. We did it. She actually carried it on for more years. I think it might still be active now. We were like the founding members together. And we probably got, you know, 20 to 40 girls to come out and, you know, just like juggle and, you know, play some matches and some drills and stuff. And like those girls, I still am in contact with, and they still play. And they're super disappointed I'm a runner now. Cause they're like, I thought you were like this soccer player or whatever, but, I'm like, I'll come back and we'll do some like, you know, hurdle drills or something. I'll start a running camp. But yeah, I mean, I was completely invested in soccer. I still love the sport so much. And you know, one of my best friends, Emma Nushi, she played soccer at NYU, and you know, a lot of my circle is Division I or former Division I soccer players. So still love the sport, but yeah.
I mean, so it seems like you came from this big passion for soccer to, you know, a coach noticing something in you and running wise in high school. So then what brought you from there to deciding to run Division I at Loyola Marymount?
Yeah. So like I said, I just like fell in love with the sport. I was surrounded by really great athletes when I was at Miramani. Cassie Haskell, who runs for Cal right now, and Hannah Fishlow, who used to run for Cal. They were like our core team. And we were, you know, we went to Arcadia. I think we placed third or fourth in the DMR. Like we were really popping off at the time. And I was able to get my mile time down within like probably two seasons of track. My junior and senior year from 5:45 to like 5:03. So it was like a very fast progression for me. So I think during that time, I just sort of realized that I could be competitive with this and like that I loved it so much that I didn't want to stop. And so as a high schooler, you're like, well, if I don't want to stop the sport, then I'm going to go into the NCAA. There's not really another option if you want to be like competitive, right? And so I, you know, started reaching out to different people. I was doing a lot of emailing, and I felt like because I was late to the game, it was hard because my name wasn't out there. So the recruiting process was like extremely difficult because I had to like basically say, I think I have potential because I'm new to this sport, unlike a lot of other athletes. But you have to trust me on that, basically. And so one of the only teams that really was interested was LMU. And I like had really no prior interest in going to LMU. I was like thinking I was going to go to the East Coast or like this big school or like University of Georgia, like something like, you know, so different. They reached out to me and I had a phone call with them. And I just remember it was with my assistant coach, and he was just so nice and so kind. And like, you know, one of the big things that I said to him was like, I'm a low mileage girl because I'm new to this sport. Like, I'm really not doing more than like 30 to 40 miles a week max. Like I'm really new to this and I'm progressing. And so like, I need a program that can like take me under their wing and like progress me into the athlete that I want to be, but it's not going to be like me going, you know, 70 miles a week, right off the bat. That's just not me. So,
which yeah. I think shows a lot of maturity as a high school runner to notice that and be able to voice it to a coach.
Yeah. I was lucky because I had a high school coach who was like, you know, like you have to make sure that the college coaches know your situation. And he was like, you don't want to get sucked into a program that is just going to like run you to the ground. And I thoroughly thought like LMU, when I talked to them, we talked about, you know, doing cross training and like, you know, taking a day off, like things like that. And I was super excited about that because like the high school program I was in, it was all about recovery. It was all about, you know, yes, doing the miles and doing as much as you can, but also like, given the circumstances, sometimes you have to aqua jog or sometimes you have to bike. Like, that's just how it is. Like, we always, if we were hurting, like he would make us, like he would drag me off the track, you know, he'd be like, come on, like, you know, like it was always me who was like pushing the boundaries, which I think is an important thing as an athlete is like, you know, trying to find that line between like pushing yourself and then also like making sure that you're being safe and, you know, taking care of yourself. But I think when you're really competitive and you're young, like you don't really have a radar for that and you just want to push. And, you know, most coaches I had before this were like, slow down, put the reins on it. But that definitely changed when I went to college.
And I think that it's so important that you bring up that like push mentality, which yes, maybe it's a young person thing, but I also think coaches need to be cognizant of the fact that it's often a distance runner mentality because in order to be successful for as a distance runner, you have to be driven sometimes to an obsessive, excessive degree. And I think that maybe more often than not turns into this push mentality, which coaches should be cognizant of.
Yeah, because you're like, you know, we're all obsessive over this sport. Like, I'm someone who I would consider a very type B personality, but when it comes down to running, like, I'm checking my watch, I'm looking at the numbers, like, I'm looking at the heart rate, like, and I want to be more relaxed with it, but I naturally just like, it's just like something instilled in all of us, I feel like, in distance running, where like you're kind of a little crazy for doing this sport and you have to be obsessive. So I think that is something that coaches need to be more aware of is that like, we're, you know, pushing the boundaries. Like if you're at the Division I level, or if you're like actually a really competitive person, like you're definitely naturally pushing that boundary always. And coaches need to learn, like, they should push you for sure. But like, they also need to keep in mind that sometimes we're pushing it so much that we're not taking care of our well-being because we'll sacrifice that because we don't know the limit. Like, that's just part of distance running, unfortunately.
Yeah. Perfect segue, because on March 27th, you shared a letter on your Instagram page highlighting abuse at the hands of the Loyola Marymount cross country and track coach, Scott Guerrero. When did you first notice that there is this toxic culture? Because I know it was years of this culture building and many different experiences. So I'd love to hear about the first time you noticed something was off.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where like when I came in, I was very trusting of the program and I, you know, did everything that my coaches told me to do. And that ended up pretty poorly for me because I ended up entering into this vicious stress fracture cycle. And it started with, you know, my first semester at regionals, I had been running on a stress fracture in my foot for a while. And it had been hurting for a long time. And, you know, I didn't really notice anything like too concerning at the time because I was just sort of buying into the program. And I just thought, you know, this is what it takes. But, you know, I ran two races on that broken foot. And like, it was hard for me to even run in between conference and regionals. I was having a really hard time at that time. And I remember being in so much pain and going to the trainers and being like, there's something really wrong with my foot. And it was always like, you know, the trainers didn't do any MRIs or anything at that time, but they were like, it's probably just like an inner muscle thing. Like, we don't really know. But, you know, it turned out I had a stress fracture. And I was, you know, devastated, obviously, because I had never had like a stress fracture before. I just like heard of other athletes who do the crazy mileage and then, you know, get them. But one thing that now that I reflect on that time period, I went from being, you know, a 30 to 40 mile girl to, you know, consistently doing above 55 miles a week, sometimes doing 60 to 65. And so it was a huge jump for me and I bought into it. I was doing doubles. I was doing hard workouts, you know, everything. I sort of was like, okay, I know they said that they understood my story, but they're just trying to get me to be good. And we had a lot of meetings where it was like, you know, you have to do this to be good. And so I bought into it. But during that time, I think what really made me notice that there was at least something wrong was the fact that I had, two girls that I knew that were struggling with eating disorder issues. One of them was my roommate at the time. And she was super talented. And she has a name like in California that people know because she went to the state meet. And of course, that's really hard. And she honestly, she had no business even going to LMU. She was such a good athlete. Like she could have gone to the top, you know, Division I schools if she had wanted to. But we got the superstar and she was also the nicest person ever and, was my roommate. And basically during the course of that first semester at LMU, I sort of watched her deteriorate in our room. Like, and what I mean by that is like, she is like a fantastic runner. She was getting, you know, results and she was right behind like our lead girl who is now a professional athlete. So like this girl, like she was popping off. It was really sad because, you know, I would see her, you know, logging her food on her phone. I at one point heard her like in the bathroom and sort of wondered if she was throwing up. She, you know, was definitely not eating enough. I caught her binge eating my food one time and she wrote me this like super sad letter saying she was sorry and that she like couldn't control herself and she was losing herself and like, that she was such a bad roommate. She became like super paranoid too. And I felt so bad for her because she was like the sweetest person, but she it got to the point where her mental health was crumbling so much that if I would see her, like she would literally like run away from me. Like she would like, was so scared of talking to other people. It was like just a really bad situation. I don't really have words to describe it, but like, she was not okay. She was clearly losing a lot of weight, and tracking everything. Like anytime she was eating, she was on her phone tracking it. So, you know, that season right before I had, gotten my stress fracture in my foot, I went to the coaches and I was like, there's a serious problem, you know, with my roommate and I'm really concerned about her. And I don't know what to do. Like, here's my story about everything that I've seen. And I remember this conversation so well because it like clicked in my head that something was really wrong with this program. My coach looked at me in the eyes and he was like, you don't understand, like she wants to go pro and you don't like understand it. Like she's doing what it takes. And like, I don't think he said that as like, you have to have an eating disorder to become pro. I think he said that like, oh, like, I don't believe she has an eating disorder. when there was clear signs. He also said, like, you know, she's just like, you know, kind of a weird girl, like an awkward girl. Like, she isn't the normal human being. Like, I think you're misinterpreting, like, what's going on.
Oh, God.
And I felt like super, I mean, at the time I didn't have this word to describe it, but I felt super gaslit because I lived with her. And I was like, no, this is like happening. This is happening right in front of me. I'm pretty sure she's making herself throw up. I'm pretty sure she is logging all of her food. I'm trying to talk to her, but she keeps running away from me. She's locked herself into the room when I'm not there. Like, it's, she's not talking to any of our teammates. It was a bad situation.
I just want to say, I mean, all these behaviors point so clearly to an eating disorder. And I think if anyone has any education on an eating disorder, I mean, isolation and not being able to control food, often different cycles of restriction and binging, so yeah. Clearly an eating disorder. And it's shocking that a coach wouldn't have the education on how to deal with it and then wouldn't want to deal with it. I mean, maybe to state the obvious, but I'm always shocked to hear.
Yeah. I'm like, have you not dealt with this before? Because it was so shocking to me because it was so clear. I mean, my friends, all my teammates and I knew. Once we saw the binge eating and once, you know, she wrote me a letter and was so like apologetic, I realized that her mental health was on the line. So even if you didn't believe that she had an eating disorder, like at least she needed some sort of help. She needed, you know, someone to check in on her. She probably shouldn't have been running at the time. What I later found out was she left that semester, like shortly after that semester. She didn't finish the second semester. And, you know, there was no conversation about where she went. It was like, I knew that she had left, but not from my coaches. We got to practice and she just wasn't there anymore. And I found out through a couple other girls later on, a couple years later, that she had attempted suicide on campus. And none of it was ever talked about. Like when she left, one of our shining stars, like not that that matters, because I don't think it does matter. She's a human being and she should be loved and cared for. But, you know, the fact that she was one of our best girls and she was just completely forgotten about, and nobody ever addressed anything that happened. Like, I just remember the space that was empty in the weight room where she used to work out. So it was really sad. She did try to come back. She was only there for a little bit. And I remember she would like come to practice, but she wasn't running. And I later found out that she had attempted suicide again. Yeah. And, I'm friends with her. So we have talked about this story. This isn't like hearsay. I knew that, you know, some of this was happening at the time, but I didn't know it fully. But she ended up, you know, never coming back to campus. And she's told me that he never really reached out to her after.
I mean, lives are on the line here. And you, so yeah. This friend of yours attempted to commit suicide twice, was sent away from campus. You mentioned in your letter that also 3 out of 5 teammates at one point struggled with eating disorders. In any of
that's
these
like
points,
diagnosed too.
Diagnosed, which of course many eating disorders go undiagnosed. At this point, was there any response from the coach in any of these circumstances?
I mean, honestly, like each girl that went through, I had another friend that left that second semester because of an eating disorder and she never came back and it was never talked about. And I went to his office for that too. And it was all sort of dealt with the trainers and with him, but I never really knew the full extent of how they dealt with it after, but I just knew that whatever they were doing was definitely internal. Like it wasn't them going to the greatest extent to reach out to all these doctors outside, or, you know, like just like you would with a stress fracture. If you get a stress fracture, you're no longer seeing the trainers. You're also going to an outside doctor, right? And you're getting MRIs. You're going, you know, I would go to Curlin and Job, like this great institute that does all this amazing work. And, you know, I'd get help right away. That never really happened to my friends. And I've noticed like anytime that we, because throughout the years, there's been more eating disorder concerns and issues and girls who have been diagnosed with them, whatever. When we go to the coaches about it, it's always like, oh, well, give it to the female assistant coach to deal with, and she'll help like usher like some sort of change, or she'll try to, you know, help this person. But the thing is, like, she's not an orthorexia, anorexia, bulimia specialist. She's not an eating disorder specialist. Like what we should be doing is like seriously reaching out to, I mean, we have the best trainers and the best, like outside doctors, like that are connected with LMU. So like they should be reaching out to the hospitals outside and like saying like, this is a serious problem. It shouldn't be dealt with internally. It was always sort of monitored by the coaching staff, but I mean, I've seen people just completely, their mental health completely spiral. And the only thing that really saved them was either leaving LMU or a summer vacation where they could go get help at home, or, you know, it was just really negligent.
My understanding is that it wasn't just this internal negligence when dealing with eating disorders. It wasn't just this ignoring or mismanaging eating disorders, but it was also active promotion of disordered eating behaviors. I know that there were meetings about race weight. There was even a formula that was used to calculate race weights. Could you tell me more about that and the role that the weight conversation played on the team?
Yeah. So what's hard about talking about this stuff is like recalling every single meeting where things happen. But I remember this one meeting that we had, and we basically, it was like a beginning of the year meeting where, you know, we have all these people come in and talk about basically LMU and athletics and whatever. And it's specifically for the freshmen that are coming in, but like we all have to be part of it. And I remember sitting down and, you know, our coach pulled up the slide, and it was this race weight slide. And it was always posed to us as like a suggestion, but it was like a strong suggestion. Like, you don't have to do this, but if you want to be competitive, like this is kind of what it takes. And like, we have to be realistic because like we're distance runners, and like, if you want to be good, like this is just what it takes. That's kind of how it was posed. It wasn't like you have to do this, but it was always like, when you're like a college athlete and you look up to your coach and you're a freshman, of course you're going to do what's on the screen, right? Sure.
So, and again, we talk about that distance runner mentality, like do whatever it takes, you know, push, push, push. If your coach tells you to do something, if there's another avenue that you can get into to make yourself a better athlete, you're going to do it.
Exactly. And so all I remember was like this formula that was given, and he was like, so it's like based on your height and your weight and, or like your current, something like height and like, I don't know, a bunch of different factors. I didn't really like look into it too much because I didn't believe it. But I just remember like we had these notebooks that we would like sketch in like different notes and stuff during these meetings. And I remember like seeing all these freshmen around us, like just sketching down this formula, and like even like just like so many people calculating what their weight should be. And like when one of my best friends and my roommate did hers, she was like, I'm like so off. And she was like, this is, you know, really screwed up and this isn't right. But she was like, this is crazy. Like, I'm supposed to be like 20 pounds lighter. Like, that's just not realistic, right? Especially when you're a distance runner, like typically, like you're going to be smaller, and like, you don't need to lose weight. You need to be eating, right? So I remember coming out of that meeting, I was furious. Like, I remember talking to some of the freshmen and I was like, okay, don't listen to that. Like, that's not what we're doing here. Like, I don't think he gets it, whatever. But then I saw one of my teammates who had been struggling with orthorexia, and she was crying, just full out crying. And she was like, I can't believe he's doing this. Like, I can't believe that he put that up there. Like, all these girls are going to like buy into this. And that's when it like really hit me, was seeing her, like a girl who's trying to heal from her eating disorder, you know, just sobbing over the fact that this is being perpetuated. So
I am blown away by your maturity, because again, I keep coming back to this distance runner mentality and how easy it is, even if maybe you don't believe this is absolutely correct, but if your coach gives you a task to do, it's hard to not get trapped in that mentality. So I'm blown away by your maturity and saying, I didn't believe in this formula, so I didn't look into it. You know, I was telling freshmen not to worry about this. How do you think you were able to disalign yourself from these ideas that your coach was preaching?
Yeah, I mean, it took some time. My first 2 years, I felt like I was trying to buy into the system, even though it kept failing me. But once I had, you know, 2 stress fractures in my foot and then 2 stress reactions in my back and 2 bulged discs, I knew that there was something going on. And I started sort of speaking out more on the team about, you know, this isn't right. Like, the way we're treated isn't right. Just like sort of the things he said during the time I would push back on. And I remember like feeling like I wasn't doing the right thing at the time, because I felt like I was being sort of a rebel. Like I wasn't being, you know, the goody two shoes girl who just does what coach says, like I had been in high school, like I have been my whole life. But I was challenging him, and I would, you know, talk to my teammates. And he has this rule on our team. It's like no talking sideways. But like, obviously, my teammates and I, we would always talk to each other about these things. And I just remember sort of like feeling this solidarity between, I mean, not all of the team, but a lot of the distance girls, especially my junior year, where we like knew something was really like fucked up going on. And like that we had to speak up and like lead the team a different way.
First of all, I mean, I want to comment on that last thing that you said, that you wanted to speak up, but I also want to pause on the fact that you had 2 stress fractures in your foot, 2 fractures in your vertebrae, 2 bulged discs in your back. Those are some serious running injuries. How did he respond to all of that?
That's like probably the most traumatizing part of this story is like when I got my first stress fracture, it was posed to me that this was normal for a freshman. Like this happens, whatever. And, you know, I was like, okay, sure. And, you know, after 3 or 4 months of being off from my first stress fracture, I went straight back into regular training. Right. And he, you know, kept pushing me, was like, very like, you know, we got to get you back fast. And, I ended up re-breaking that same foot, probably like 3 or 4 months after it had been cleared. And so after that, I was like, you know, he said something to me, like, I don't know why this keeps happening to you. And I knew, I was like, the trainers and even the doctors that I saw outside of LMU, because I went to multiple doctors, I got blood work done. I got everything under the sun done, all the scans, everything, because my dad's a doctor. And he was like, what is happening to you? Like, how are you having like 2 broken like incidences, like whatever. So I basically did all this testing and all the doctors were like, nothing's wrong with you. You don't have a bone density issue. You have a mileage issue and you need to be taking like a day off when you come back and progress more slowly. You came back too fast. But anytime that, you know, the trainers would give me a plan to come back, say like, you know, I just had been cleared, the next day I'll do 5 minutes on the road or on a sidewalk, whatever. And then the next day I'll cross train and then I'll build up to like 10 minutes and then I'll take a day off. Right. Anytime I was given that, there was so much pressure by my coaches to just not do that always.
Like, which always. Again, like standard, I'm having trouble keeping a straight face. If you probably see as I'm listening to this, I'm like standard stress fracture protocol that I think almost any athlete knows is that slow progression, walk, run to run again, very slow, just as anyone should know the easy, simple, recognizable eating disorder traits. I mean, it's just shocking.
Yeah. And I remember this specific incident, which kind of like set the precedent for the rest of my career. Before I got my scan on my first stress fracture, I was in this parking garage with my coach because he was like driving me to the doctor. And I remember like specifically where we were, he was like grabbing the ticket. We were driving in and he turned to me and he said, have you felt real pain before? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I just raced 2 races on my foot and like, I can't walk on it. Like, I cannot bear weight on my foot. And he was like, well, you know, you were a soccer player before. So like, I don't know if you've really felt real pain before. And he's like, running is pain. Like, do you get that, Rosie? And I remember that it was like the most condescending like conversation, because I had a stress fracture. I didn't know it in that parking garage, but I was about to get the scan for it. And I remember thinking, like, there's something deeply wrong with this conversation. Like, the fact that he doesn't believe that I'm in pain, like that I would be making this up, or that it's like a slight injury. And that, you know, happened throughout my years, where he consistently told me if like my foot was flaring up, or if my back was hurting, or, you know, anything was happening, he would call them ghost pains. And, you know, a bunch of the girls on the team that I've talked to who are victims, they've also shared the use of ghost pains, just like throughout their history at LMU. But like, what he meant by that was that it was in my head, and that I was projecting my like fear of like getting injured onto my foot. And like, I don't even know, it was like this, like, it was this term that I knew he used incessantly over the 4 years I was there. And he would just say, like, your pain isn't real. Like, you're making this up basically in your head. Like, he wouldn't straight out say it, but he would say it with ghost pains.
One thing that comes to mind, I mean, beyond the blatant athlete abuse, and I know one thing you talked about in your letter too, is the power dynamic here, in that you are both a woman and a woman of color, and yeah, this is a man telling you that your pain isn't real. Yeah. Did that power dynamic ever enter your mind when this was happening?
So I'm a women and gender studies major, and I've learned a lot about cycles of abuse, and I'm also a political science major, and I work in politics. So politics is power. That's like what I study, basically. And during the time, I think I was so in survival mode. Like, I was so tactical about everything I did, because I didn't want him to punish me. And I didn't want him to, like, I just didn't want to get injured. I just wanted to, like, basically graduate. Like, by sophomore year, I was like, I just need to graduate. And so I didn't really think about like how that was problematic until I got to Boulder and was surrounded by some of the best athletes in the nation. And, you know, I spoke up about my story, and like my friend Steve and like a bunch of other people, Perry Bockroth, all these great runners were like, dude, like, that's not normal. Like, what you experienced is beyond what the Division I like level is supposed to be about, I guess. Like, it's not supposed to be intrinsically abusive. It's supposed to be like hard, but not abusive. And I feel like your story is more than just hard. So I didn't really think about it as much when I was in the program, because I honestly was probably, I mean, I think I was depressed at multiple points at the time that I was there. And I felt like each year was just surviving. So I was just trying to get through. So I didn't really think about, you know, those conversations, other than I knew that they were wrong.
Well, I'm really grateful for your friends in Boulder for having that conversation with you. One word that you said earlier was punished. You didn't want to be punished by him. I know that you've also mentioned that you were punished for social media posts.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit more about those posts and what that dynamic was?
Yeah. So I think it's important to sort of like tell the whole story in this, because it was like a certain season that this started really happening. So it was when I was coming back from my back injury, and I was, you know, doing low mileage, and I was at the point where I was like, okay, enough is enough. I'm doing what the doctors are telling me, and I'm doing what the trainers are telling me. And, you know, he like had texted me and basically told me, like, if I didn't amp up my mileage, I'd be sitting out a lot for the season, whatever. And I was like, you know, like, I have to do this. Like, I've been injured so much. Like, I'm just going to do what the doctors say, whatever. And he sort of like agreed with that at some point. Like, he was like, whatever. It wasn't like him agreeing. It was just him being like, okay, you do you. It was always like post, like the way he would talk to me was super passive aggressive, like always. And it was always like, he basically, he would liken me doing wanting to do low mileage to me not caring anymore. So he like essentially gave me the tone that he had given up on me when he started to agree my junior year that I could just do lower mileage. Not because I wanted to, but because I had multiple medical professionals telling me that I needed to.
Yeah.
So, you know, at that same time, I think the season before we had so many girls injured. Like I think only three girls on that season had finished healthy.
And out the rest of how many? Of us,
I think it was like seven plus.
Yeah.
So there was like definitely like many girls injured at the time. I know it was like, you know, two girls that were healthy or maybe three girls, two and a half, something like that.
Well, regardless, I mean, yeah. Over half of the team has season ending injuries. That says something to you.
Yeah. So it was like kind of a concern on all of us. Like we were just really fed up with it. And so we all started asking for a day off and we all started asking for some like mileage adjustments, all of that. And he called a meeting at the beginning of the year and he was just so pissed like at all of us. It was just with the returners. It wasn't with the freshmen. And I think now like looking back on that, I'm like, of course he would separate the freshmen from everyone else because he like would yell at us in those meetings and he wanted to like look good to the freshmen. But he basically just like was super mad. And he was like, do you guys even care? Like, we're not going to be good. Like, I don't understand why you're all asking for a day off or why you're asking for lower mileage. Like, we're just not going to be good this year. Do you understand that? Like, I don't even want to take you guys to regionals, like all this stuff. It was just like one of the worst meetings. Like, he basically just like dug into us about how we don't care. And like, all of us there had some injury. Like, it was just crazy. And so I remember like coming out of that meeting and we all like hugged each other and we were like, we're going to be here for each other. You know, screw what he says. Like, we just need to do what we need to do. Take your day off, just lie, whatever. But what came out of that was his, that's when the punishments really started to happen because he knew that we weren't going to agree with what he was saying anymore. And so he knew after that meeting that we were all sort of on the same page. And I think he felt like because I had been the one who had spoken out about the eating disorders and about my injury and all this stuff that I maybe was a ringleader in this. Mm. So he targeted a lot of the punishment on me. There was, you know, a time that semester when he didn't call me in. He actually referred me to the compliance director because he had gone through my social media and found a picture that I posted. And it was like a collage. It was like when doing collages was cool on social media, right? So I bought into it and I had this girl who's a really good friend of mine. She made me a collage and I was like, thank you at, you know, Milehole Designs for making me look pretty. And I got called in to compliance, not even to my coach, about how I was, it was like a violation, like an NCAA violation because I was using my name and likeness to promote a design account. First of all, I knew people who had been like on the cover of magazines and coach didn't know about it.
And you weren't getting money for this.
No.
Yeah, no, there's
absolutely. Okay. No. And I told my friend and she was like, why would he get mad at you for just like posting a photo? It's like tagging someone, right?
Right, right.
And so
like he's looking for some way to
He always monitored my social media. That's like a prevalent theme throughout all this was he would always go through it. And also all of those meetings that I had about my social media, it would always digress into like not being about social media, but about how I didn't like, it would always digress into mileage and how I wasn't doing what he was saying. And so like the social media post plus me not doing what he was saying was a problem. And like, it just was always so manipulative. Like it never really had to do with the social media. It had to do with him wanting to punish me because I spoke out. The next story I have that I remember was, I had gone to Big Bear one weekend. This was right when I was like coming off of my back injury and Big Bear is like 3 hours away from, LMU. It's just like a place in Southern California. It's like where you can go like camping and there's trees and it's really pretty. It's like very, it's like the Boulder of SoCal. And so I was really struggling with my mental health because at this time he had already sort of like done all these like small punishments. So I told my, one of my friends and then my ex-boyfriend slash friend at the time, like we should go up and they're both on the team. And I was like, let's just go for one day. Like, let's clear our brains. Like, let's go for a cool run, like whatever. And we had a recruiting weekend that same weekend, but I went, so I went to Big Bear Saturday to Sunday and the recruiting weekend was Sunday to Monday. So I knew I had to get back in time for the recruiting weekend. Like, it's like a team policy. You have to be there.
To tell everyone about this lovely program.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the time I was, you know, I was drinking the Kool-Aid. So I definitely was, you know, just saying what I needed to say, which now I look back and I'm like, oh, why did I do that? But anyways, so there was a recruiting weekend and I needed to get back in time for it. Went for a cool run, spent the night in Big Bear, drove back and, you know, went to every single recruiting event that weekend, the Sunday to Monday. I drove the recruits everywhere. I had a great time. I felt like I really bonded with them. And like, I knew multiple people who were not there from Sunday to Monday or weren't there Sunday. Like they were at Disneyland or like somewhere else. I wasn't bothered by it because it was kind of normal that some people wouldn't be there. But I got a call on Tuesday from my coaches and, or a text from my coach during work. And he was like, I've taken you off the roster or like, I've taken you off the, I forget, like the racing, whatever. So your name isn't on the list and you should come into my office. And I was like, okay, like, did I do something wrong? Like I was super confused. Like I had no idea why he was talking to me like this. And he was like, well, if you didn't do anything wrong, like I wouldn't be having this conversation. And my heart like sunk. And I literally started crying because at this time, like stuff had happened all the time. And I felt like I was walking on eggshells. So I just burst into tears and I was at work and my boss was like, just leave. So I went to his office and he was like, you know, like I have grounds to like kick you off the team. You weren't there during the recruiting weekend. You posted a picture on social media of you at Big Bear. And he like was furious with me. And I was like, are you kidding? Like I was there for one day and like I was the only girl who went to every single event. Like I was the main girl at the recruiting weekend. And he was like, well, the fact that you posted something on social media during that weekend, you know, it makes our team look bad and our team is very disappointed in you. He said that my teammates were super disappointed in me.
Oh God. It's
yeah.
And just and the entirety of this is infuriating and just all of the abuser behaviors, this stalking your social media and finding little details to play into. It's incredibly cringy to hear about it now.
Stuff like this happen all the time. And it's hard because when you talk about abuse, you're like, it's just so encompassing, right? Like people don't believe you unless it's like this physical thing that you have bruises on you, right? Like I have to go through the story time and time again and tell like all these little stories and things and people still are like justifying it, right? Because psychological abuse isn't this like this thing that you can just see. It's something you carry with you. I can see it. And I know multiple people, probably 15 people who have gone through it just from this program. And yet that's not enough, right, for people to understand it, which is frustrating.
That's a super important point. And it leads us to talk about right now, because I know it became very important for you to share this abuse and to make other people see it and understand it. On March 27th, you wrote on Instagram, my Division I NCAA Loyola Marymount cross country and track coach psychologically abused me in ways I cannot process, cannot describe, and cannot fathom. What caused you to finally share this abuse publicly?
Yeah. So like I said, I had moved out to Boulder right after COVID had broken out. And part of that was because I needed to get out of LA. I felt very mentally drained my junior year just by my coaches. They took everything out of me and I went to my happy place and while I was there, they never really reached out to me, never asked how I was doing, nothing. I texted my coach and told him my stepdad had cancer. He didn't really respond to it or check in with me about anything. When the mass shooting broke out in Boulder, he never texted me. Like, I'm still technically on the team, so I would have expected like he cared, like that he might care and, you know, check in with us. But he never like checked in with me ever during that time, a whole year, basically. The only time he like checked in with me was when he sent me a form that I forgot to complete for like NCAA compliance or like school compliance, something like that. And he sent me a passive aggressive text that was like, it would really make my life a lot easier if you would complete this form. But no, hey, how are you? I haven't talked to you in months. You know, it's a pandemic. Like, are you good? There was none of that. I get really emotional when I like think about all the stuff that I went through during my time. And so some days I wake up and I think about when I'm running, like how freeing it is that I could run here healthy and happy, and how horrible it was when I was there that I was just, you know, struggling so much. And, you know, it's crazy. Like it's black and white, right? Like I came here and I'm running the fastest I've ever run in my life and doing way more mileage than I normally do, but it's because I was able to progress and take time and do what the doctor said. And I'm so happy now. I work for the Colorado legislature. I'm a legislative aide. And so our whole thing is like on my team with my boss and my state representative, they're like, speak up, like say your truth. Mm-hmm. They're always super encouraging, like about how I feel about certain policies. They want my advice. And that's really inspired me, because for so long I was quiet about things and I was just sort of not dismissive. Like I knew something was wrong and I would speak up behind closed doors, but I knew that that wasn't working and that I had to do something and that I would be the good person to do it, because I'm a very sensitive person. Like I care a lot about like what people say to me, and I get hurt easily, but I'm also a really strong person. And so I think that lets me have like some empathy for people and like be there for people like victims who have similar stories, but also like keep pushing. I honestly just like, I woke up one morning and I was like thinking about everything that I had gone through and what my roommate's gone through, Holly, and like everything that has happened over these last several years, and thought about how happy I am, but how mad I was that I had gone through such a traumatic experience. And so I actually went on Twitter first and I tweeted that my coach had psychologically abused me, Coach Guerrero, and that I have no tolerance for NCAA coaches that perpetuate this violence against people. I tweeted it and I knew that there would be people who would support me, but I didn't know that there would be like outpours of support. You know, like I feel so grateful that all these people trust me with their stories and they're there for me in solidarity, or they, you know, just want to say like, I stand with you, whatever. Like it is so, that part of it is so beautiful, because I feel like the one thing I want from this is a community of people who can like, you know, envision change and demand it and like keep pushing the sport in the right direction. Like I could ask for nothing else. Like if this investigation ended and he doesn't, you know, get kicked off the team, at least I know like there's this community and this conversation that started. And like that has completely, I didn't know that that was going to happen when I first tweeted it. So it's definitely been an interesting process.
Well, first of all, I want to go back and say that I'm so sorry to hear about everything you've been going through personally. I mean, with your stepdad and just as a member of the Boulder community, on top of this psychological abuse that you've been dealing with, I can't imagine. And you are, you know, as you said, both sensitive and so brave. You can hear that when you're talking, and I think anyone can gather that. And I also want to go back to, you know, you mentioned that you want to open up this conversation and you've been hearing this response when you posted on Twitter and Instagram, you got this response. You also shared that it's not just an LMU problem. This is a wider NCAA and specifically NCAA track and cross country problem, this abuse and enabled disordered eating. What was some of the response from other NCAA athletes that you received?
Yeah, I mean, I think the what's really crazy is when I tweeted what I tweeted, it was right after the whole thing blew up about the women's basketball, the NCAA tournament, and then not having like the right weight room. And there was like such a disparity between the men's weight room and the women's. So that blew up like 2 weeks before I tweeted everything. And then this happened. And I knew one other girl who had tweeted about the University of Alabama, Birmingham coaches, I believe. And her coaches were fired because of like racism and abuse and very similar things. Her story is slightly different, but same premise basically. And I just felt like people were ready for this conversation to happen. Like I felt like I was just sort of grabbing onto other stories that had happened previously, and like the Mary Kane story, like, you know, there's been a couple instances of people, you know, speaking out, whatever, on their team.
Sure.
And
it's happening again and again.
Exactly. And so I felt like I was just like hopping on that train too, not because I wanted to, but because I knew that that was the right thing to do, was to speak out about it. That I think has been the most inspiring part, is just like all these NCAA athletes reaching out to me from different sports, from different time periods. Like, you know, some are like 10 years ago, some are like 2 years ago or right now, who are just so like, they're like, I didn't speak out about my story and I wish I had. And like, I was always so scared, or, you know, they mentioned the same things that I went through. And I've gotten hundreds of messages from different, mostly female identifying athletes who have spoken to me about these issues. And it makes me so sad, because I'm like, obviously there's a problem if so many people are just holding this in, and they're like, it's like a steam valve where like one person releases a little bit of steam and then everyone's like blowing this up, right? Like this has all been unspoken. There's a culture of silence. So that part has been like inspiring, but also like mortifying to me, because I'm like, how many people have reported these things, and like how many people are still silent because they're scared or whatever. That part is really, really concerning to me. And so that's when I was like, we need to talk about the NCAA. Like, I know people have been talking about it, but we like really need to be talking about it.
You also asked in that post, if you could reimagine college athletics, what would it look like? And I want to turn that question back to you, because as you have been speaking about, there's a huge problem in the NCAA. So what would college athletics in a better world look like to you?
Yeah, I mean, well-being over profit. I think one of the main issues is that the NCAA is a multi-million dollar business model, and it's exploitative in its nature. I don't know about, you know, when it was founded. I think it was around 1903. It was nearly a century ago. And, you know, I don't know about then, but what I know now is like these people, this like corporation essentially makes so much money off of the work that we all do, right? And, you know, I've heard my coach told me multiple times that this is a business model about his own program. And so it takes what it takes because it's a business model. And what that means to me is like everyone in this institution that is an admin or higher up, right? They're exploiting us. They're gaining profit off of us. And what I said in that post, or in several open letters, is I think what's important is like we need to see a dramatic shift in that, which I don't know if the NCAA can even do, but like profit is, I think that student athletes should be able to profit off their abilities. Maybe that's an unpopular opinion, but I think there's a movement for that right now.
For sure.
The second thing is like there, when I was, you know, trying to report these things to people, everything is dealt with internally within universities. And I think that there's something really wrong with that, because there's not really a lot of oversight from the NCAA, especially for sports like cross country that are like not profit sports, right? They don't bring in all this revenue like football does. But like, I went to the NCAA website and I was like, how do I report this stuff? And like, I need a phone number. But they just had like a physical address on there. So like, you know, there's no like oversight. Like, I need to be able to go outside my institution and have someone like report what's happening or like do some sort of investigation. Because if you do an investigation in the school, they're going to naturally want to save face. That's just the way the system works.
Yeah.
So the lack of oversight and accountability by the NCAA, it's really concerning to me. And I think there has to be a dramatic reshaping of that part of it. But also, you know, with sexual harassment, assault, eating disorder issues, all of these things, they need to be more than just a course where like coaches just complete this course that they click through, right? Like we all have done that. It needs to be more than that. You need to, the hiring process needs to be like, what is this person's intentions? And like, what's their experience with female athletes? What's their experience with injuries? Like, what's their record? There has to be continual check-ins. Like I said, promoting the well-being of athletes first, because like overall we gain benefit if athletes are mentally and physically there and happy. We all benefit from that because their performances will go up. So that needs to change, but also like, especially right now, I just think the treatment of women and LGBTQ plus and specifically trans women, it's like astounding to me the way the NCAA just doesn't support them. Our voices are often silenced. What are you actually doing, NCAA, about Black Lives Matter? What are you doing to support athletes? Like, it just doesn't add up to me. And so that needs to change. But I don't know how you can do that within the NCAA. I honestly don't know.
It's certainly not an overnight solution, but I think the start is you. The start is people like you and what you're doing, and everything you're saying is just so true about what changes need to happen. And all of your thoughts are, I mean, you're so intelligent. The way you speak about these things are, they're words that I hope everyone listens to. And you mentioned earlier that you were a bit of a rebel. You felt like a bit of a rebel speaking out about these things. And I think you are, you're a rebel in the best possible way, because that's what a change maker is, in my opinion. So I want to thank you for everything that you've done. I know I can just sit here and praise you forever. We can just do that for the rest of the episode. But before we go, because we've talked about some pretty deep things, I want to have a little bit of fun. So I have a few rapid fire questions. Are you good with that?
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing about running?
My favorite thing about running is the community around it. I just feel like I remember my first day at track practice, and like everybody, whenever you run past like the boys team or another team, they're always like, hey, good job. Like I never had that in soccer. So I think it's just like the community and the support. Like there's just such a, like, especially in Boulder too, there's such a support system here.
Keep making me want to move to Boulder.
Yeah, do it.
So I was going to ask, what's your favorite place in the world to run? But I might know the answer to that now.
I can give you a specific place. I am obsessed with Bobo Link. It's a trail in Boulder. And it's just like this like flat trail that like goes right outside the mountains. People talk about like Magnolia Road, like Mags and Rollinsville. In Boulder, but I think Bobo Link is super awesome. But that's like my happy place. Like if I'm ever feeling sad or, you know, thinking about these things, I'm always like, I'm just going to go for an 8-mile run at Bobo Link.
Amazing. Do you have a favorite book you've read or movie you've watched over the past year?
That's a really good question. I read The Bluest Eye, by Toni Morrison. And that was probably one of my favorite books. And my favorite movie this past year, man, it's either Borat 2, because I think it's hilarious. I honestly don't watch a lot of movies because I like have to be like moving and grooving all the time. Like it's so hard for me to sit still.
Yeah.
But
this is hysterical because I have the same exact thing. And so I don't know why I asked this question, because I hardly ever watch movies, and people think it's bizarre, but I'm so happy that we've found that in common, because now I feel a little less weird.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm also a big Toni Morrison fan, so I'm happy that you brought that up. The last question that I like to ask everyone, why is sport a powerful platform for social change?
Wow, that's a great question. Because this is sort of cliche, but I think it's really true. When you are a runner or when you're on a team, it's just like all these different types of bodies and people who are just, you know, all focused and determined and committed to this one thing. And it doesn't matter who you are. It's about the runner you are and about how much you put in work, right? I mean, it does matter who you are. But I think what's beautiful about that is like, it just brings all these people together that wouldn't normally be together. And you have to, in a team environment, work with each other and accept each other. And so I think as a platform for change, that's the perfect environment to be in. You want to be working with people who have different backgrounds, who are, come from different places, especially when you're on a Division I team. You know, there's people all over the world that are coming in. And having that those different perspectives is super important to promoting change and doing it in the right way. Having voices heard is like the essential way that we change everything, and especially around these conversations with the NCAA. Like, we just need more voices from different teams and different backgrounds.
That's not cliche at all. That is beautiful and so true. Everything you've said is just so important. And like you said, I mean, this is a systemic issue in the NCAA. This is an NCAA issue. It's an issue in the entire sport of running. And I am just so grateful for people like you who are speaking out about it, because that's what leads to change. And I know so many people are. So thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really glad that I could talk to someone about this and, you know, get the word out that we're, you know, leading the charge to just make it a better space for college athletics.
Thank you so much, Rosie, for sharing your story and for being a vocal advocate of change in the NCAA. I really do think that sharing stories and speaking out is a crucial step in fighting for change in what really is a systemic problem in the sport of running and in the NCAA. I also want to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this tough and important conversation. The best thing you can do to support the show is to leave a rating and a review for Social Sport on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow Social Sport on Instagram @SocialSportPod. And you can subscribe to the Social Sport newsletter at socialsport.substack.com. You can also reach out to me directly, slip on over into the Social Sport DMs on Instagram, or share Social Sport on your personal social media, share it with your friends, with the people you run, bike, and hike with. I so appreciate any and all support. Thank you for joining me today. Stay sporty and keep resisting.